Hey, pull up a chair. We're so glad to have you join us here on the Back Porch Education Podcast. For the next half hour or so, we're going to talk about all things educational. It's a wonderful day to learn something. Glad you could join us.
Good evening, good morning, good afternoon. I'm Jason here with Steve again on Back Porch Education. And last time we talked about education as the cultivation of wisdom and virtue. We'll get to this whole wisdom idea and cultivating it later, but as for virtue, that's kind of what we want to focus on today. If we're going to cultivate it, it's going to require us to both understand virtue and how to cultivate it. So that's what we're going to dive into today. But first, as always, let's start with a poem. This poem is entitled "The Day Is Done," and it's by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. The day is done and the darkness falls from the wings of night, as a feather is wafted downward from an eagle in his flight. I see the lights of the village gleam through the rain and the mist, and a feeling of sadness comes o'er me that my soul cannot resist. A feeling of sadness and longing that is not akin to pain, and resembles sorrow only as the mist resembles the rain. Come, read to me some poem, some simple and heartfelt lay, that shall soothe this restless feeling and banish the thoughts of day. Not from the grand old masters, not from the bards sublime, whose distant footsteps echo through the corridors of time. For like strains of martial music, their mighty thoughts suggest life's endless toil and endeavor, and tonight I long for rest. Read from some humbler poet, whose songs gushed from his heart, as showers from the clouds of summer or tears from the eyelids start, who through long days of labor and nights devoid of ease, still heard in his soul the music of wonderful melodies. Such songs have power to quiet the restless pulse of care, and come like the benediction that follows after prayer. Then read from the treasured volume the poem of thy choice, and lend to the rhyme of the poet the beauty of thy voice. And the night shall be filled with music, and the cares that infest the day shall fold their tents like the Arabs, and as silently steal away. That was Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, "The Day Is Done," one of my favorites. So now with that ringing in our ears, that music ringing in our ears, let's dive into it. Steve, what do you say?
Yeah, great poem to start with. If we're going to talk about virtue, I can't think of anything more directly and yet obtusely related to virtue than memory.
Oh, yeah.
And here this poet is asking, you know, find me some poetry, find me something from the past that can give me some rest here at the end of the day, give me some sense of significance, give me some enrichment of my soul. And education is not a forgetting of what has come before and what we've known in the past. It is remembering. In fact, it's interesting when you start playing with that word to remember.
Right.
We're literally putting the members back together.
Right.
And there's this notion that the human endeavor is a form of membership, that we are getting back in touch with those who've come before us, and what they've what's inspired them should also inspire us. And so you have this notion of virtue, this notion of doing the right thing. We've discussed in education for a long time this notion of permanence. What can I teach that will last past the test, that will last through the summer? You know, 30 years from now, what will the kid remember from this sophomore English class? And virtue is the most permanent thing one can learn, because it isn't just for this life, it's for the next life as well. And that's a pretty long time. That's an amazing thing. And so when I'm trying to motivate myself as a teacher, I quickly get sort of past the notion that, education is just knowing things to the much more exciting belief that it's about being able to do things. And so that's, I think that's how we've arrived at this discussion of virtue. And it's a, as we said in our previous podcast about the 1850 thing, when you go back prior to the modern notions of education, this is how people defined education across geography and history and culture. You find almost every culture that believed in education, believing that the main thing, what I want my child to learn from that teacher, is how to be a good man, how to be a good woman. Yep. And there's a long history of that. I know you and I have discussed.
That's even offensive to the ears that today, though, right? I mean, like, there are people who just would hate that idea, right? Becoming a good person because you learn from your teacher. Like, yeah, it's a lot different.
Yeah, well, and so we apply that to our study of history in particular, and make every major historical figure out to, in some way or another, have been a bad man.
Well, there's that.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so why would you even study these guys? Because they were all, you know, you could fill in the blanks, but they all owned slaves, or they all were this or that or the other thing. They were all bad people. Well, only a pretty proud person would exclude themselves from that camp.
Exactly.
We all need to learn from one another, and from the best of the best come the best lessons. So, and this goes way back. I know, I think we want to talk just a little bit about the history of thinking about of virtue in education. You know, we could start way, way back, but probably the most obvious place is maybe with the Greeks. Talk a little bit, Jason, about virtue with the Greeks.
Sure. So let me say this, though, before I hop into that. I'm glad that you told us about sort of the way you made sense of that poem, Longfellow's poem, in this context. I picked it for a totally different reason than what you said. I picked it because when I'm thinking about virtue and I'm talking about virtue, it's something that's very exciting to me. I taught a high school ethics class that I absolutely loved. My students were fantastic. It was just a blast. But it's really heavy, and I am a poor and miserable sinner, and there are definitely times when I have this feeling, sort of like Longfellow shows us here, this idea of, oh, don't read from the grand old masters, not from the sublime poets, but just read from somebody gentler, read from somebody humble, because their words, those grand old masters, sometimes their words are like martial music, right? The drum before battle. And sometimes it's too much. Yeah, it's hard.
Sometimes I'd rather laugh with the sinners than cry with the saints.
Have I worked
Billy Joel into the conversation?
I don't know if I want to go that far, but okay. Somewhere in between, maybe Plato and Billy Joel. So yeah, okay. Well, we'll try and fit it in real quick before the break here. We'll probably fail, but that's okay. So let's start with Plato. What we know about Plato is his idea of the forms, how that was so important to him, right? This idea of these guiding forms or principles that are guiding everything, right? And they are how we understand the world around us, because the world around us is based on these things. And so for Plato, what we see with virtue is, you know, for him, virtue is understanding these forms, understanding the way the world works, so that we can live in harmony with it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. Sort of making the soul whole, living in harmony. Okay. And that's an idea that Aristotle picks up on and advances.
Yep.
And it's to our great benefit. And that's where we'll start after we pick it up from the break. So, Aristotle, I promised a little bit on Aristotle. I can nerd out on this, and I'm going to try hard not to. Steve, you're going to have to keep me honest. But with Aristotle, what we see is the word that I want people thinking of when we are talking about virtue and thinking about Aristotle in particular is a word that I've heard pronounced a lot of different ways, but my philosophy professor taught me to pronounce it eudaimonia. And this is an idea which is often translated happiness, human happiness. Before that, it used to be translated human flourishing.
Yeah, I've heard of
that. And so in any event, the idea of eudaimonia is this. Eudaimonia is the fruition or the perfect flourishing of a thing. So the eudaimonia of an acorn would be a big, beautiful oak tree, right? Symmetrical, not cattywampus or silly or anything like that, but just perfect, picturesque. So I think that's a really helpful analogy because right away, okay, if I'm the acorn, what does it look like for me to flourish? What does human eudaimonia look like? What does it look like for a man or a woman to be the fullest form of that thing? So whatever that is, and we'll get to it more later, I think, but whatever that is, that was Aristotle's idea, that virtue, so the highest virtue is eudaimonia. And all the other virtues, which there are billions of them, serve to make a man or a woman excellent in the highest virtue, which is eudaimonia.
Right. So if I've got you in your explanations, Plato gave us this notion that there is a perfection, and Aristotle comes along and says, yes, there is, and it's found by seeking to be who you ought to be, by growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And what I always appreciated about Aristotle is that he viewed virtue not as a static thing, but as a journey.
Right.
One grew in strength in the virtues by finding the middle of the road.
Yeah, the golden mean, right.
That you could have too much of whatever that thing is that's leading you towards virtue. If just for an example here, if courage is a virtue,
mm-hmm.
you could have too much of it and become a rash person.
Right.
Have more courage than one ought to have and do stupid things.
Yes.
15-year-old boys come to mind for some reason. and then in the other ditch is the one that we often pit against courage, that being cowardice, the cowardly lion who can't do anything because he has no courage.
Right.
And both of those are vices. The rashness and the cowardice are vices. In the middle, the moderate courage is what we're all aiming for.
That's right.
And so I guess it sort of begs the question in education. Well, there's a bunch of questions that it begs. One that Plato dealt with was can you teach virtue, or is it just there, or, you know, how does one come by virtue?
Mm-hmm.
And that might be a whole series in of itself. Right. That's a pretty big question. Right. And then if you can learn it, which would seem to be implied, at least by our definition of education, that you can lead one toward virtue.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? What do you do to get it?
Right.
And I think that the beauty of this is, again, and I wholeheartedly embrace your interpretation of Longfellow's poem, but where I started is this notion of memory. The beauty of trying to educate in the 21st century is that we've got 20 centuries before us, at least.
Absolutely.
To work off of. And so the Greeks give us this theory of virtue that the Romans then, I'd say what they gave us was the demonstration of it, at least for a time. We often talk about the fall of Rome and its loss of virtue, but for a while they, and I love the notion that the best way to interpret the term is through flourishing,
because
that fits with our agrarian definition that we got. You can cultivate something till it flourishes, right. And so the Romans did that, but they also, I think, without intending to do so, began a long set of stories about this one group of people in particular who evidenced virtue perhaps more than any other group of people, the Romans, in seeking to stamp them out because they were bold enough to say that there was but one God and you'd better worship him or you're in trouble. The Romans, of course, carried around a briefcase just adding gods into it as often as they could. But the exclusivity of Christianity, which I'm talking about, and the notion of the gladiators and the lion's den and so on and so forth, here's these people with the courage and many other virtues, patience, etc., to die for what they believed in. And so Rome not only has its own nobility within its ranks, but it starts a long line of martyrdom, and maybe my goal is not for my students to be martyrs, but to have the virtue that were they called upon to do so could be such. And so the Christian story at this point, and I want to make sure we distinguish between using virtue as an excuse to moralize, Johnny, you ought to be like this, because that's what's we're not suggesting you use this to preach sermons, though that's appropriate in some contexts. But real education fills out a soul to where all it wants and has a taste for is right action and right belief, and right. That's a deeper notion. So how did the Christians then pick up the ball from the Greeks and Romans? Where did they go with that?
Sure. Yeah, I'm glad that you sort of segued to there, because, you know, for Aristotle, for instance, his idea of virtue, or the place where virtue was most practiced, most practiced, we'll say, was the battlefield in war.
Yep.
Right. Well, the early Christians, they disagreed. That was not the fullest expression of virtue. I think it was something closer to, like what you're saying, to martyrdom, because of their context, right? So the Greeks give us this idea of a virtue as an action. It's not something that you sit around and think about, but it's something that is done. So if you, the virtue of horseback riding, or the virtue of, anything, the virtue of farming, right?
Plato, it could be anything. Flute playing, if I remember. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, okay, we have those virtues, and they distinguish, Plato and Aristotle, distinguish four virtues that are really important, the four that are sort of the linchpin for all the other virtues. Okay. And so those four are prudence, or wisdom. Okay. Temperance. We might say
self-control,
having a level head or something like that. Self-control. Yeah. Great. Courage or fortitude. And then justice. And these, they said these four, the Greeks said these four, these are the most important. And I'm pretty sure that it was Ambrose who came along after them. And he was the first person to call those, he named them the hinge virtues, okay? Because everything, every other virtue, all other action hinges on these four super important virtues. And the Latin word for hinge, like a door hinge, is cardo. And so from that word cardo, we have the cardinal
there you go.
Virtues.
All righty. Learn something today.
So, yeah, it's a neat thing. So
but I thought,
that's four of the
seven. Yeah, I was going to say, I thought there were seven, and you're saying they basically taught four.
They did. And I'll give you the other three after the break.
Hey, during this brief break, I wanted to encourage you to use the share buttons we have on our website in order to help us get folks tuned into the show. Our goal is to encourage as many educators, homeschoolers, NFL punters, and donut makers as we can with these podcasts. So help us get the word out. Share our Facebook page. Send folks a link to one of your favorite episodes. Do whatever you can to help us share this craziness with either your best friends or, if it's more appropriate, your worst enemies. We will love you all the more for sharing our love. Thanks. And now, back to the show.
All right. So, we talked about the four cardinal virtues, but seven is typically what we hear. So, the other three then that come along, this would be, I don't know, I guess some people could say that Ambrose or Augustine added them. I would say that Paul added them, because the three last virtues, or they're often called the three theological virtues, and they are faith, hope, and love.
So how would you distinguish then between the four cardinal and the three theological? How are they different, or how do they work together? What's the relationship? Why do we tend to say there's seven?
Well, I think that the church formerly didn't have as much of an issue as some parts of the church have today with borrowing from the pagans. And so I think that the early church was really content to say, okay, well, yeah, of course, the Greeks have shown us this, and it's great. These are the four cardinal virtues. But the church or God has shown us these three theological virtues, and four and three make seven, and seven's a holy number. It's a number of wholeness, so this is wonderful, and this makes our seven.
Yeah, I think that there's a sense with the three theological virtues, as the name implies, being transcendent.
Right.
Right. That unless God grants the ability, man's pretty helpless. loving someone, having hope in what? If there's no God, what is there to hope in? Faith is the most obvious of the three. With faith in what?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that a human can have faith in another human. That's not real wise, but they can do it. They obviously can love one another, but get lost as to how to do that if the love of God is not informing that love. And true hope, real hope, is not hope in tomorrow, as in the next day on earth, but a hope that's beyond this life.
Yeah.
And so I think that It's fascinated me that those big three that Paul says the greatest of these is love, mm-hmm. but all three are there, are intertwined. It's like a three-legged stool.
Yeah.
I don't think you can have any one of those three without having something of all three of them. Mm-hmm. And Paul doesn't just say it once. He says it in almost all of his epistles. He somehow or another references at least one of those three in reference to another of those three. In more than just 1 Corinthians, I believe it's Philippians early on, he commends them for their faith, which is evidenced through hope brought about by their love. You know, and so he's even willing to tie them in that they lead towards each other. The four linchpins, the four hinge virtues, seem to be implied that we would learn that from each other.
I think the Greeks definitely thought so. I think that the church comes along and wants to even kind of give credit to God there as well, which I'm happy to do, right?
Right, right.
I think the church is right.
I think there's much more of a secondary means to the notion of courage or temperance or whatever. That if we want to talk about role models, we are all going to fall short on the faith, hope, and love thing.
Yeah.
But I can find someone with more courage than myself, and by watching, or more wisdom, or more temperance, whatever, by watching them and seeking to imitate them, become better myself, which has a lot of ramifications for all of education, and in particular for the humanities, right? For history and literature, there's something about both positive and negative lessons to be learned from a guy like Achilles, for instance, or Mr. Macabre, or whomever. The great characters of literature and history placed before us, helping us form our moral imagination. They give us these stock examples to work off of. You know, I can remember my youngest days being told to be like David. You know, now as I approach my teenage years, it would be like David with Goliath, not with Bathsheba. You know, but so there's flaws in human examples, no matter whom you choose. But I knew what they meant.
Yep.
I knew the story of David and Goliath. I knew when my mother would tell me to pray like Daniel, you know, the lion's den was right there for me to go, wow, okay, like that. Right. And often knew that she was referring to the fact that my dad could easily be a lion if I didn't behave correctly. So, right. Well, I don't want to shortchange it, but I also don't want to turn this into just completely a history lesson.
No,
I think throughout the Middle Ages, as education, as Christian education, as Europe tries to sort of codify education, build upon what it's received from the Greeks and Romans, and from the early church fathers, they hold on to the seven virtues and even start emphasizing the seven vices. And, as is inevitable with something as old and venerable as this, there's even disagreement as to exactly what those virtues or vices are. But I think for our next podcast, it would be useful if our premise is so, if education is about cultivating virtue, then it behooves us to spend a little time trying to not just define each of the virtues, but exemplify them a little bit. Talk about in the classroom, what's the role of courage? You know, what are you talking mm-hmm. about?
Spelling bees.
In particular, the three theological virtues, the problem might be that they're so big that it might get lost on us, the role they play in real education, that living in a world the way God has made it means that we have to find ways to increase our faith and our hope and our love. And that at the heart of living well in this world are those three virtues. And I'm concerned, very concerned, that in our society, by kind of losing sight or by relativizing those things, that love is whatever you say it is in your heart, or faith is more, it's almost a faith in data these days rather than in God, or hope is that next check, you know.
Or the next election cycle.
As we kind of misplace or confuse these virtues, it's just having catastrophic effects on our society. And so what gets me excited about real education is that if this is its focus, this is more than just getting kids into college. This is more than just bumping up test scores. This is society recovering what it means to live a good life. And I will gladly give my life work towards that end in a heartbeat and be happy, knowing that others are happy for joining me in it. So until next time, prosper and do well, and keep thinking about education.
Be virtuous.
Be virtuous. That's right. And maybe exercise the virtue of a nice comment. If you think of it, we long to make this interactive. We've kind of started things out here with our thoughts, but we've got a comment section to the website. Please make use of that. Let us know what you're thinking about the things that we're saying. And we'll catch you again here soon. Well, thanks again for joining us in this great conversation about education. We hope you will not just listen, but participate. Leave us a comment, suggestion, or thought on our website. You just never know when we'll use it on the show. Until next time, pursue joy and learn something.